Hello and welcome to the Heat Check Sim Show with your host, The Real Sim Shady. It's been about 2 weeks since our last episode, and in those 2 weeks, we've had a number of significant events within the Heat Check Sim universe. So I'm excited to bring you a lot of information over the next episode or two. This episode, I'm excited to bring you a quick update on what's going on with my Liberty Flames, give you an idea of where we're headed for the next season and hopefully beyond. And then I'm also going to provide and share with you guys a great follow-up conversation I had with Radford's head coach over the results of the draft declarations that we saw for season two. So kind of just following up based on the conversation we had, about the trends that he was able to identify from the draft declarations from season one, and see if there's anything else we can't learn from, season two's draft declarations, both alone and also in tandem with season one's, another year, another data set for Radford's coach to work with to see, if there are any new trends he was able to identify, or more importantly, just, if the trends he identified previously are still relevant and continue to be relevant. So I'm excited to bring you those things in this episode today, and I hope you guys really enjoy it. As a quick update as well, I've announced it on Twitter. I've mentioned it in the Discord, but I'm also going to be recording a podcast with Fake Joe Lenardi over the coming days. And so we're going to be providing a super deep dive into season three and a preview for that. So I can't wait to share that with you. We've got a ton of fantastic information. I know there's already been some great information shared on Discord, on Twitter, by a number of different people. It was incredibly impressive what Idaho State's head coach was able to do in such a short amount of time, releasing that Excel spreadsheet with all the, improved teams over season two onto Discord. So, that was incredibly impressive. We're going to have some of that information. We're also going to have a ton of information that we dug up, that specifically Fake Joe Lenardi dug up, that I don't think anyone else really has been able to dig into yet. So I think that episode is going to be fantastic. But first, let's get to today's episode. We're gonna get into my little breakdown on what's going on with Liberty, and then I'll share that conversation with Radford's head coach shortly after that. So it's been a couple episodes since I really gave you any kind of an update of what's going on with Liberty within the Heat Check Sim universe. So I'm excited to give you guys a little bit of an update on what's going on within my program going into season three, my perspective on what's going on, and then give you an idea of what I'm kind of expecting from my team for season three. So, kind of going back to the transfer market, the draft declarations, I'm a prestige six school. I didn't have any players rated higher than 7.2 last season. So I wasn't worried at all about draft declarations. Nobody in my squad did declare, so I was safe there. And then in terms of the transfer market, I didn't have any open roster spots. I didn't have any seniors, but I did kick a few players off via recruiting. So I didn't have any open roster spots, but I did feel like there was a chance to, make an improvement through the transfer market. So I figured I would take a swing at one player and see if I can, make an instant impact through the transfer market and make my team better going into season three. So what I did is I offered point guard Alfonso McNeely. He was a 9.7 overall. He would have been, a couple points better than my starting point guard or my only point guard going into next season. So would have been an improvement there. He would have actually been my best player. But ultimately, he chose to go play at Notre Dame. I can't blame him. It's a great program. He gets to play in a much better conference. But he would have been the stud at Liberty. That was kind of what I was trying to sell him on. Ultimately, like I said, didn't land in my favor. So I'm happy to move forward with the team that I, had last year, plus a couple recruits that I was able to bring in through. One of them was a JUCO guy, one of them was a freshman. Those guys are both going to be instant impact players. So looking forward to seeing my team develop into next year. In season two, we had gone with a 5 in terms of development. So we were able to improve from 6.71 overall. And the number I'm using, that number is basically just the overall average of my 8 players was 6.71. Strength of roster was 313th in the country. But we've improved to, going into season two, we're going to be 8.81 overall and a strength of roster of 211th for season three. So improvement from 313th in the country to 211th. That's good for the 20th most improved team in the country in terms of improvement of strength of roster from that 6.71 to 8.81. Just about a 2.1 improvement. We're, like I said, 20th most improved team in the country between season two and season three. And not only that, we're the 9th most improved team in the country if you start from season one to now. So, I mean, you could say it's not super impressive because we did start at the bottom of the barrel. We're 346th in terms of strength of roster at the beginning of season one. And, you know, we're only at 211th now, but we still have a long way to go. We think we can get a lot better. We can get a lot more out of the guys currently on our roster and build for the future, get some recruits moving forward too. So definitely excited about what I can do with this team in the future. But specifically looking at season three, I finished putting together my season three non-conference schedule. So I got, I'll run through that really quick. I was able to lock up an away game with Seton Hall, who's the 45th best team in terms of strength of roster. They were a NCAA tournament team in season two. So I'm looking forward to, you know, going down there and seeing how our boys can compete. And then I've got a home game scheduled with Radford. They're 51st in strength of roster. And actually that's a return game. We played them last year in the Pitsnoggle Invitational on the road. And actually, you know, they were the best team we played last year. They had a strength of roster of 107 in the country. And that was a team that we ended up beating. We beat them on a buzzer beater on the road. And that was actually, it was the best team we played, obviously the best team we beat. And it was the first win I had as a head coach for Liberty. So a lot of significance there. Excited to invite those guys into our home arena and take another stab at them. I've got an away game at Wake Forest, who's 128th in terms of strength of roster for season three. A little bit of a rebuilding year there, but another chance to play a power six school. So excited for that. And then I've got a home game against Wagner, who's 197th. This is the best team they've had during the sim to this point. So I think they're, you know, things are looking up for them as well. Excited to have a matchup with them. And then we also have a home matchup with Louisiana Monroe, who is 215th in strength of roster going into season three. They were a season two NCAA tournament team. So, you know, another NCAA tournament team we're excited to get an opportunity to play against during our non-conference schedule. And then in terms of our protected rivals, we have a little bit of a revenge tour going on for season three as we lost all four of these games last year. But we've got Longwood on the road this year. They are 301st in terms of strength of roster. We lost to them 58-46 last year. We've got Winthrop, who is 184th in strength of roster. We've got them at home. We lost to them by 5 last year. Gardner-Webb, we've got at home, who's 199th. We lost to them by 21 last year. And then Houston Baptist, we've got on the road, and they're 331st in strength of roster this year. So we lost to them by 8. So those are our protected rivals in addition to the 5 we scheduled on our own. And then we also have our non-conference tournament, which is the Queen City Classic. And this tournament's a lot better than the tournament we were in last year. It should be highly competitive. We've got, you know, listed from best to worst in this tournament. We've got Notre Dame, who's 59th, Iona's 64th, Maryland 71st, UMass is 74th, Indiana State's 139th. We're at 211th, and then American's 228, Hofstra's 232. So should be a competitive field. Depending on how exactly we get matched up, there might be an opportunity to win a game or two in this tournament. We'd love to be able to, you know, get a matchup with Notre Dame, get a matchup with Iona, Maryland, UMass, any of those schools are at the top. We'd love to get a chance to, you know, shock the world and upset one of those schools. And just overall, you know, from our non-conference schedule, we've got plenty of opportunities to win games. We're going to be favored in, I think, 3 of those 12 non-conference games, but there are a handful of teams that will be neck and neck with, have a chance to beat as well. And then, a couple teams that are, we're kind of outkicking our coverage in terms of teams that are, we're playing teams that are significantly better, but we're going to give it our best shot and see if we can pull an upset or two as well. And then for our conference schedule, going into season three, we're actually projected to be second in the Atlantic Sun behind Florida Gulf Coast. Unfortunately, the Atlantic Sun is actually the worst conference in the country in season three. I mean, that doesn't bode well in terms of building up our strength of record or anything like that. We're going to be playing a lot of teams that are lower in terms of that strength of roster metric, but it will provide a lot of opportunities to win games and hopefully give our guys a better idea of what it takes to win games, especially in conference play leading up to our conference tournament, where we're hoping to make a run at that conference tournament championship. But I mean, this is a big time improvement for our team. We were worst in the conference in season one. We were sixth best in season two, so marginal improvement there. And then we're all the way up to second best in season three. So great outlook in terms of being able to be competitive in our conference. And then the other thing about our team that's exciting is, again, this is another year where we don't have any seniors. We have one freshman, four sophomores, and three juniors. So this year, I haven't fully decided this, but most likely going to go with full development again, which should enable us to get to a 10.71 overall for next year, just based on the development traits that my players have, in conjunction with that full development that I'm debating on choosing. So unless so we're looking at 10.71 overall for season four, unless we're able to improve our roster further via, recruiting or transfers, if we're able to get lucky in one of those departments and land a guy despite not really focusing on recruitment. So either way, season four should be an exciting team, should be the it will be the best team we've had to date in the sim. And should be a team that should contend for the conference championship and hopefully make some noise in March Madness should we get there. So looking forward to that. But for now, really all I can do is focus on having a good season three, doing everything that we can do to, continue to improve, let these young guys develop, and then ultimately see if we can't make a good run through the conference tournament and get into March Madness. Just as a quick intro for my guest for today's episode, I'm bringing back Radford's head coach. You can follow him on Twitter at RadfordHCSim. And as a reminder, he was the one that we talked to a couple episodes ago about the draft declarations process and all the trends he identified to help you kind of figure out if you have any players that might be in danger of declaring for the draft early. I didn't plan on having a repeat guest this quickly on the show because I really do want to talk to every single person that's expressed interest in being on the show. But the information he provided on his first appearance was received really well, and I thought it might be helpful to have a follow-up conversation to discuss the results of the draft declarations. But also clear up any questions that coaches had about the draft declarations process. So, we're going to discuss the results of the draft declarations for season two, how the trends he had identified based on season one fared based on the results of season two, and if there's anything to be learned from another season of data gathered on the topic. So, without further ado, here is Radford's head coach. Welcome back to the show. I'm excited to discuss the draft declaration results and insights from season two with you.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for having me again.
Definitely. Like I kind of mentioned previously, I wasn't anticipating having anyone on as a repeat guest this quickly, but I think you were able to dig up a lot of valuable insights on your first go around, and I think you've got some more stuff in store here. So I think it'll be another valuable listen for people. So I'm excited to kind of dig into some of this stuff, but before we get into that, just have to touch on the fact that we did schedule ourselves or a matchup between ourselves for season three's non-conference, and you guys are going to be traveling down and to Lynchburg, Virginia, to face the Liberty Flames. What are you feeling about that
Hey, we gotta redeem ourselves. That things got ugly the last time. We were we had high expectations for last season, sitting around like a roster rank of 100, and then you guys just came to town. We completely overlooked your 300 something ranked team, and you ripped our hearts out at the buzzer.
Yeah,
That
I
happened.
mean, that was my first win as a Heat Check Sim coach. So, it's got a lot of sentimental value for me. I'm hoping the guys on my roster understand the significance, the importance of that matchup, and they can, you know, repeat the magic this year.
Our guys.
I know you have a super squad this year, top, I guess it's like the 51st ranked team in the country. So it'd be a tall task.
And we'd be lying if we didn't say that we had an X marked on this game from last season, the moment that that buzzer beater went in. So we're ready.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it looks like your non-conference schedule is pretty daunting. And then you kind of have us as your cupcake matchup. So I'm hoping by the time you guys see us on the schedule, it'll feel more like a look over game and we can sneak up on you again. But I understand that last year might have opened your eyes a little bit. So we'll see how it goes. I'm excited for it.
I applaud that strategy. I see what you're doing there. Just trying to sneak in there and be like, you don't need to worry about us. We're fine. Just go play the Washingtons, the Minnesotas, the Creightons, George Mason.
Exactly. Exactly. We'll be happy just, you know, coming in undetected and pulling some magic. But yeah, it should be a fun matchup again. I like the fact that it's interstate. You know, I looked it up. We're an hour and 40 minutes apart via car. So hopefully we can keep your crazy fans out of our arena.
The Rowdy Ratty Nation they're getting crazy. They're gonna come out.
We gotta sell our tickets quick for sure.
I do like, by the way, the whole concept. I'm not from Virginia or anything, but like just the whole concept of trying to create the Virginia rivalries and whatnot with you, George Mason, Virginia Tech following season, just kind of trying to create a little sim rivalry in state would be kind of fun to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. That was something I really didn't even think about last season. And then, you know, something I saw you mention on Twitter and I think we might have talked about it too, but I do like the idea of kind of leaning into those interstate rivalries and I guess it's intrastate. Intrastate. those rivalries, like you said. So I'm hoping, I can get, you know, maybe the Virginia Techs, Virginia's, George Mason's, all those schools on my schedule in the future as well. But for now, I'm satisfied to have you guys on our schedule and see if we can go 2-0 against your squad.
Does Virginia have a Heat Check account or anything like that? Like, they are one of the most infuriating teams because they've been so dang good every year, but I can't find them. Like, I don't know where they're at.
Yeah, I haven't seen them anywhere either. So I'm not sure. They definitely don't have a Twitter account dedicated to it that I'm aware of. I'm not even sure. Maybe they're on Discord, but they're just not active. I'm not sure. But yeah, that'd be it's just kind of unfortunate. Yeah, we don't really have the ability to, you know, schedule them non-conference-wise as of right now, but hopefully that changes. Maybe they see one of like the Discord link and they, you know, become a little more active. I think Eli adding that to the emails has been a plus. We've gotten a bunch of new coaches on the Discord channel, you know, over the past week or so. So I think that's been good. And hopefully that number continues to rise. We can get even more interaction.
It almost feels like when you're playing fantasy football and you're losing to the team that auto draft a great team. Like, oh my God. Like I can't even talk crap to them.
you just, I don't even know if you realize it, but you directly called me out. So I joined that, the Heat Check Fantasy Football League with, you know, full intention of being highly engaged in it and then just completely missed the draft.
Oh, no.
So I'm that guy. I almost that like never happens to me. I'm never the guy that auto drafts. And then of course this league, I completely missed it. I missed the boat. So I auto drafted, not super satisfied with my team. So if I win, it's like, I'm in a position where I can't brag about it. And if I lose, I do have that built in excuse, but it's not, it's ultimately my fault. Right. I missed the draft. So, not a great look, but hopefully I can just be somewhere in the middle. So it's not much of a problem. I don't have to worry about bragging, but I also don't have to be the guy that, you know, finishes 0-13 or whatever and is embarrassed, but
immediately the most disliked person in the draft, the guy that auto drafts.
Oh, 100%. I felt horrible. But you know, I mean, that's the way it goes sometimes, but
didn't mean to open that wound. I had no idea.
Nope, no worries. All right, so let's get into this draft declaration results from season two. So just as a quick disclaimer, you were on the show in for episode 3, so 2 episodes ago, and so if you're a new listener, and this is, you know, maybe the first or even the second episode you've listened to, what I would do is at this point, I would pause this episode and I would go back and listen to episode 3, where we gave a full rundown of all the, you know, the trends that kind of you identified that could indicate your players are likely to go pro early. So, if, like I said, if you haven't heard that podcast and you're listening to this one, I would pause this one, go back, listen to that one, because there's a ton of valuable insight in that episode. And we're going to touch on a lot of the things that we discussed in that one. But if you want a full breakdown in a lot more detail, I would go back to that one, listen to that first, and then come back and listen to this, where we're going to give a lot. There's going to be more insights on the results from season 2 and you know, how the season 2 results kind of have shaped the way we were looking at those trends and things like that. So, okay, now we can move on with the people that have already listened to, you know, that previous episode. So, like I said, last time you were on the show, you broke down the 6 factors that you identified that, you know, could lead to players declaring for the draft early. And so, you can, if you want to, you can just give a super brief rundown right now of like what those factors are, and then, we can go from there, I guess.
For sure. So, yeah, the 6 things that we talked about last time were in not any main particular order, but like we did think that the leading scorer and the low high development were the top 2 for importance. And so you had a leading scorer, how many times your player led their team in scoring. If the player is a low development or a low loyalty, high development player, that was a huge factor. Team prestige of if they're coming from a school like Duke, or if they're coming from a school like Radford or whatever, the higher the prestige, the better the school, the more likely they are to go pro. Top 5 player on a roster, meaning if they're a starter, they have a significantly better chance of going pro. The guys that were 7th and 8th in the roster season 1, we identified, did not ever lead their team in scoring, and none of them ended up going pro, no matter how good they were. If you're someone that's a 7th or an 8th player on a team, like for instance, Indiana happened again this year. Indiana had a player that was one of the best low loyalty, high developing players, but he was their 7th best player, never led their team in scoring, didn't even declare, let alone have to come back from the draft. Overall threshold, we last year designated it at around 10. If the player was lower than a 10, you'd have to worry about the other factors of them potentially going pro. And we'll jump into that one again this year and see what changes we might have seen in that. And then year in school, freshman last year made up, there were 39 guys that went pro last year, 40 guys that went pro this year early, and 50% of them about last year were freshmen. And we'll talk about and see if those trends continue. Almost no juniors season 1. That might have changed a little bit here this year, and we'll talk about all that.
Definitely. So, yeah, and that's another thing. So, yeah, that's a great brief rundown of, you know, the things that we talked about last time, just as a refresher for everyone who listened to that one. And, you know, that's a great point that, you know, these things are going to develop. I mean, you only had one data set to work with for the trends that you identified for season 1's early draft entrance. So the fact that, you know, we have another data set, and the fact that this data set, you know, effectively doubles the information we had last time is significant. And so there are going to be some differences that you've identified. Again, these are things to keep an eye on that could indicate your players are going to go pro, but none of these are necessarily hard and fast rules. There could be exceptions, just like there is in real life. There could be exceptions, but you know, the things that you're touching on are going to be things that just could be bigger indicators of the factors that could be that could influence your player's decision to go pro early. So we can kind of dig into those now for season 2. I don't know if you want to start with the trends that kind of stayed the same or the trends that differed first based on what on your results from season 2, but I'll kind of let you run with it a little bit here if you want to.
For sure. So the main thing that I noticed from this year is that there were a number of things that mixed up to an extent. There weren't the certainties. Like the first year, there were guys, we had talked about how there were 7 players that were 9-plus time leading scorers, and 5 of them ended up going pro. this year, Western Michigan's going to be very happy with me. Being wrong, Delaware State going to be very happy. I think it's State. Very happy with me being wrong. But the leading scorers, UConn, for instance, the leading scorers last year when there were 9-plus guys, 7 of them that ultimately fit that bill and 5 of them went pro, it didn't necessarily have to fit the bill of low loyalty, high development, had to be a freshman, didn't necessarily have to be one of the elite overall players. When South Dakota State went pro, at their freshman went pro at like a 9-4, whatever it was. So like we identified that as kind of, if you hit that mark, then you were ready to go. This year, there were only 4 guys. There were a lot fewer that ended up having 9-plus leading scores, but only one of them ultimately went pro. So that, for instance, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a factor, because it still is when we dive into it deeper. It just means that it wasn't necessarily a certainty of someone leading their team in scoring that many times going pro. It's not like, just because they let it that many times that they will go pro. But when we look at it and dive deeper into what I find is the most interesting portion of all this, is the fact that there are 100 guys that originally committed, and 40 ultimately stayed in the draft and 60 came back. That cutoff line was exactly the top 40 prospects of the entire player pool that ended up staying and returning. Those guys stayed in the draft, excuse me, and then the bottom 60 returned. So that part is the most wild part to me, is that like it was exactly the top 40 even cutoff, and then the bottom 60 ended up coming back, regardless of how it worked out in terms of those players that got the opportunity to try and recruit their guy back and those who didn't. 2 guys didn't return to their own school. They ended up transferring, but those 2 guys were going to transfer based on the transfer protocol anyway. They weren't going to come back. Either they're going pro or going to a different school, because those teams had over-recruited. So that's the main difference. And then when we dive into that, you'll see that the scoring still is a huge factor, but it just doesn't necessarily mean that if they are scoring at that elite level, that they ultimately will go pro. Because you look at the Western Michigan dude, he ended up being the roster ranked 6. He was their 6th man, and we identified the first year that that's not really one that is very frequent of going pro. Usually it's guys that are higher up, slash top 5 guys. He falls out of that category, so that still proved true, even though he was the leading scorer in the nation. And then looking at UConn's guy, who was the 2nd leading scorer, he was a low development guy, and he was their 3rd best player on their team. So, I mean, in a 13 overall. And so there's different things that come into play. And the main takeaway from the scoring is the fact that it just didn't necessarily mean, if that your guy was the best scorer in the country, that he would go pro. Now, if he's the best scorer in the country in a low high, then he is going to go pro. And the top 7 guys that were low high developing overall ratings, all 7 of those guys ended up going pro again. So, right. It still is a factor. It just, it alters.
Yeah. So I like to think of this, and correct me if you disagree with anything I'm saying based on what you've, I mean, you're the one that actually has really dug into this, but based on what you're saying, the way I like to think of this is kind of like a pie. And so based on what we had seen from season 1, it felt like if you were a leading scorer more often than not, it felt like that trend of the 6 trends made up a more significant slice of the pie than just 1/6. Maybe it was 2, maybe it was 1/3 of the pie, or maybe it was closer to half. It felt like it made up a more significant slice of the pie in terms of determining how likely it was that your player was going to go pro early. But now, based on the new developments that we've, or the new data from season 2, essentially, it seems like you said, it's still a factor. So it's not something to disregard. But it just feels like that slice of pie is smaller. Maybe it's closer to that, 1/6 of the pie, where I think there still is some weight, some heavier weights on certain of these trends, but maybe it is closer to that, 1/6 of the pie, and the 6 just being the 6 trends. Whereas like previously we just thought it was larger than it might be now.
Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something in terms of, slice of the pie and it getting smaller. But I would still say, like, once we get into the breakdown of the actual guys that, of the 100 guys that declared, which guys left, which guys stayed, when we look at that, I still think there's a pretty substantial trend of like guys who ended up going pro in scoring leaders. It just, I'd say it's higher than a sixth. I'd probably, put it at like maybe, you know, closer to a third, not quite, but just closer to a third. Still, but like last year it was, we probably looked at it and it was closer to half. So it's still substantial. It's just not nearly, as driving of a force to make sure that regardless of the five categories, that they'd certainly just lock in and go. This year it seems to be different, but still a huge factor.
Definitely. So we started with that leading score. So that was one thing that you noticed. It was kind of varying results. What were the other trends, I guess, that you identified that kind of had different results than maybe we looked at last year?
So this one, I'll just continue to go down the list. The low loyalty, high development portion. We had a pretty high emphasis on this last year, and I think that continues to be proven this year. The main thing that was like numbers that popped off the sheet for me was that this year, not a single high loyalty guy went pro. Not one. Mm. Last year there was kind of someone from every mix of the loyalty development range and duos, but this year not a single high loyalty guy went pro. Three guys put their name in the draft, but all three of them ultimately came back. So just like we talked about in the first go around, that loyalty makes sense as one that we would figure to be important. It even seemed to be more important than we might have even had let on based on what we saw from the first one, that not a single one did it, which is kind of crazy to me.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty wild. And I mean, it's one of those things where, they were high loyalty. They tested the waters, and then ultimately the coach, you know, probably tugged at their loyalty, heartstrings, and the player made the decision to come back to stay true to his, you know, commitment to finish out his career at school potentially. So it's kind of interesting. That's funny.
There were, just to put in comparison, there were five guys in the first season that fit the high loyalty bill that still went pro, and some of the, like, those guys that ultimately did go pro from high loyalty, a number of them were really high scorers. And so that's part of the reason why we're like, okay, high loyalty is kind of getting bucked here, just because you have this guy that is an elite production player in college basketball. And so that kind of overlooked that. Whereas this season, those guys that were really great scorers and were still highly loyal didn't end up going. So that was a big portion. The main one that I think of with that would be Delaware State's AJ Ford, 9-time leading scorer this year, 12.5 overall, pretty good darn player, but he's high developing no less, but he was highly loyal. And so he ultimately came back.
Got it. Yeah. So, I mean, it looks like that's still significant, and even maybe a little more significant than we previously thought, which, you know, I again, still think that makes sense. Not really much else to say there other than I agree with that.
One more player that fits that bill, as I look at the sheet, that, like, when I saw this guy was coming back, I was absolutely shocked. The Florida's number one player, Florida, a prestige one, someone that's likely to send people pro. Best player on their team, Kelvin Middleton, 16.9 overall, junior, 7-time leading scorer, so that means he's one of the best scorers in the nation. High developing, but he was highly loyal and he tested the waters and decided to come back. So just huge. High loyalty, I mean, this year was huge.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, based on the six trends, the only two that were going in Florida's favor in terms of trying to get him back were the fact that he was already a junior. So he wasn't, you know, that highly, had a lot of potential freshmen. But he also had that high loyalty. So it seems like those two factors were enough for Florida to be able to bring him back. That's actually pretty interesting, just from the fact that he had so many of those other factors going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I mean, that was the biggest takeaway of looking at that one, where I was trying to compare last year's numbers to this year's and just saw that. And I'm like, wow, that is telling. That was a pretty substantial upgrade. And like some of the changes that we see here and like we've talked about now and we're going to look at when we move to the next one of Prestige, it's like we weren't spot on with the level of importance that was placed on it or necessarily how much the trend matched. But this year, sometimes the trend of what you'd expect of low loyalty versus high loyalty, like it even proved itself further. Like this year, I think there was an increase of low loyalty guys that ultimately went as well. So like those guys that when you're filling out the 39 to 40 players going pro this year, when you look at it, there were guys that there were an increased number of guys. Yeah, there were 28 guys the first year that were low loyalty. This year, 31 low loyalty. So that number increased as well, and the high loyalties went down. I will say that the mediums kind of proved to be something that was a little bit more dicier too. The medium loyalty, if you're a medium high, those guys were a little tier that kind of spiked up a little bit last year. It was like 20%. Of the 39 guys were low medium development, and then this year it jumps to 25. Not a crazy jump, but still, I mean,
yeah,
1 in 4 instead of 1 in 5. It's a notable jump. So,
yeah, it kind of shows you just the importance of having that combination. If you are a medium loyalty, you need to have that high development. Otherwise, you're probably more likely to get them back.
Yeah, and even looking at the low lows, like the develop numbers of guys that went pro, there were an increased number of guys that were low development that still went pro. And I would say that most of that happens because those guys were so good overall. And we'll get to that later when we get with the overall. But like when we're this far into the sim rather than the beginning, the players are overall getting better. It's inflating the numbers and the guys that are going to go pro are going to be better. And so once you get to the 16s overall, it doesn't, for the most part, as much matter that they're low developing. They're already that darn good that they're going to be willing to go if they're that good.
Definitely. Okay. So yeah, that was the low loyalty, high development trend. So I think the next one on the list is the team prestige, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, that is correct. So yeah, team prestige. This is one of those ones where when we looked at it last year, that it was substantial, knowing that, you know, four of the 39 guys were prestige one, but again, there's only 10 teams out of 352 teams that have prestige one as their designation. And so when you consider four of those guys ended up losing the player, that's significant. This year, those numbers jumped even more. And looking at prestiges, instead of four guys of those 10 schools going pro, 9 guys of those 10 schools went pro. Meaning, you know, think about it, just about one guy per school. I don't know. I'd have to look and see which schools ultimately lost guys. Some guys might have lost multiple, but like it's an average of one guy per prestige one, just about going pro, which is pretty eye opening.
Yeah. That's interesting. I think, just further emphasize the importance. And like we talked about previously, you know, those are the schools getting the most national recognition, they're getting the most time on ESPN, and you know, those are the schools that are getting players scouted by, you know, the NBA scouts, but also those are the schools recruiting the best players. So it makes sense, you know, that combination of things makes sense that they're likely to have a lot of guys go pro.
So that was one of those ones that there was a change, but it further enhanced kind of what we had talked about and how the ones, the best schools, the guys that are getting those best players, like you say, are the ones that are ultimately more inclined to leave. The two prestige two was sitting right around the same with about 20 to 23% of the guys making up the 40 guys that went pro. There were 8 of them. Prestige three, there was a decent drawback actually, because last year about half of the guys, 20 of the guys that went pro, were from prestige three. This year, just 13. Prestige four was sitting right around the same: 4 guys last year, 5 guys this year. And then actually, surprisingly, Prestige 5 had an uptick from 2 guys the first year to 5 guys this year. So
interesting.
That was a little interesting to me. But yeah, for the most part, you look and see in the Prestige 1s, there was a really, really big change at the guard in terms of kind of it correcting itself to what you would imagine it would be. So that was rather interesting to me.
Yeah, that's another, you know, part where season one, we were using results of, you know, players that are going pro based on how rosters were assigned to players going into the simulation. Whereas season two, a lot of these players were recruited. And so if the season one or the prestige one teams were recruiting hard during season one, they brought in better players for season two and they saw more of them go pro, it sounds like. So it's going to be interesting as we continue to get further away from the start of this simulation to see how the numbers continue to evolve, just because, you know, it's going to be so different than the way the sim started. And like you said, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a second, but yeah, I'm definitely curious about that as we continue to move forward.
Side note on the Prestige Fives, just for the guys out there that are listening and like, oh God, I'm the Prestige Five. Why the heck are some of these guys going pro? Looking real quick at those guys, every single one of those five guys in Prestige Five that went pro were freshmen, and they were they were all 12 and a half or better overall last season. And so that is definitely something to look at. Two of them, surprisingly, two of them are projected top five picks. The guy, Bobby Benjamin from Furman and Johnny Hill from Ryder, both really good players, projected top five picks, both of them low loyalty. And yeah, the big thing, you know, just looking at it is the freshmen, I believe they're all low loyalty. Yep, all low loyalty. Mm-hmm. Some high development, like half of them high development. But yeah, good. It doesn't matter if it's a good player that is a low loyalty, and he's a freshman, he's more inclined to go pro. So then it proves that with looking at these guys. But the two top five scorers from that prestige were, they were both 6 and 7 time leading scorers. So that continues to hold its course. The next guy was a 5-time leading scorer, 4-time leading scorer, and there's too many guys, 3-time. So, I mean, school leading scorers matters still. Yep. And that's what happened with those guys from the smaller schools, is that they were good scorers. They're good players overall, lowly loyal, and they're freshmen. So
yeah, that I think, like you said, if you're a good player, that might ultimately be the most important thing. I think and that's going to be the next thing we're going to talk about. But just if you're thinking about the NBA scouts are going to try to find the best players they can find. And no matter where you're playing, if you're considered to be the best players, you're going to be drafted. I do think that the prestige does matter. I do think that it's not the end all be all. Like you said, there were only five guys from Prestige Five, and it was a jump. But, you know, I think a lot of those lower prestige schools that have great players, those players might be able to, you know, fly under the radar just a little bit. So if I was a Prestige Five school, I might be a little hesitant to be recruiting players that are, you know, better than 12 overall right out of the gate, if your goal is to have them play more than one season for your school. But, you know, there is also that chance that they might be able to fly under the radar and you might be able to hang on to them. Especially if they aren't that low loyalty. Yeah.
Right. To take that one step further, you don't want to recruit a guy that's like, you know, 12 and a half, 13, 14 overall. That's a low loyalty guy coming into your school. That's going to be a top two player on your team, because then that guy is going to be a pretty significant scorer.
Yep.
And he's not necessarily looking to stick around for the long haul. But again, just to remind people that just to not scare people, is that, yeah, there's a jump of looking at from, what do we say, 2 to 5 players this year in Prestige 5 jumping. Again, there are 125 schools in Prestige 5. Yep. So that still is just, you know, a little 4% makeup of schools that would be hit by that. So even though it's a jump in the grand total of things, you still have a lot of guys that would fit that same exact bill of being a 12 and a half to 14 or whatever overall player from that prestige level that's low loyalty, and they're staying. So
definitely,
it just kind of opens yourself up to the possibility of losing a guy more likely.
Yep, definitely. Okay, so I think the next topic is actually the player being a top five player on a team being a factor. Is that still the case this year?
Okay. So this one was this is very similar to the prestige, where we mentioned it being a factor. And then saying top five seemed to be the most likely cutoff. There are only two guys that were sixth man that went last year, and no seventh or no eighth best player on the team. That bench is the exact same. When you look at the numbers this year, there are only two guys that were sixth mans that went pro, and then no sevenths and no eighths. So that is the exact same. And you should feel pretty solid. And again, shout out to Western Michigan and Eric Townsend, who just dominated the NIT in my squad. 12-time leading scorer, sixth man of the year. Has to be. He ended up not going pro. So that was a huge factor, I'm sure, in him returning, is the fact that he was their sixth man. And so, but looking at the rest of it, last year we noted that the second and the fourth best player were the ones that were most notable to go, and the best player only had seven versus the second best player having 11 guys that made up the 39 that went pro last year. Now, this year, it kind of self-corrected the way that we talked about with prestige, and that's probably with more players getting recruited, better players that are coming in as freshmen or JUCOs and whatnot. This year, instead of seven players being the top player in the roster, 18 players in the top roster came in and ended up going pro. And that's 18 of the 40. So we're looking at 45% of the guys at the top roster spot from their team. And then 12 were the second best. So 75% of the guys that went pro this year were the best or second best player on their team. So that's a pretty significant trend in the direction that, like, we would expect it to, but it just, it kind of fits the curve more than it did last year.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was going to touch that same point. Yeah, it's, like you said, it's where we would have guessed it would be. It's just it took another year or so to get closer to where our expectations would be. And that doesn't mean it might, you know, reverse a little bit in the future. But as of right now, it does look like, you know, the top two players on a roster are more likely to go pro than even, the third, fourth, fifth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This year, because like I said, last year, there were a number of guys that were the fourth best player on their team that went. This year, when you take outside of the top three players that went pro, you only have about 13%. There's five guys. So about 12.5% of guys that went pro early were outside of the top three. So you got to feel pretty good about your guy moving forward if he's falling into, from especially smaller schools, but like if he's fallen outside of the top three on his team in overall rating on your roster, then outside of the top three, you got to feel pretty good. Cause obviously five guys slipped through the crack this year, but it doesn't necessarily, seem to be that way always. So.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. The next one is the one I'm super curious about, and it's the threshold of, 10.0 overall that you identified last year. And then we talked about on the previous episode. How did this one develop? Is it similar? Did it change significantly? How did this one develop this year?
Okay, so this one is actually one of the most interesting ones because it'll actually help us segue to what we want to talk about, which is identifying the players that did declare early, which ones go pro. This was huge because last year there were, like, I can't remember off the top of my head, but like maybe like two guys that were less than a 10, or one guy maybe less than a 10 that went pro, and that was, again, the South Dakota State anomaly that was an All-American, 9-time leading scorer. But this year, with the inflation of players getting better, teams overall getting better, more development, better recruits coming in, that number jumped. And this year, it looked to be closer to about, like, 13 overall. Of players that ultimately were going pro. And that we're talking about from this year. Like, there were about 13 overall from this season, even though the numbers that were submitted to the Google Doc include their overall after what they developed this year. And that's kind of a little Easter egg that we're about to jump into after. But, it jumped from, like, 10 being the threshold to closer to about 13. And there, no one declared who was worse than 11 overall, like, at all out of the 100 guys. No one declared worse than 11 overall before development. And then all but three, all but three stayed that were 13 or better. So, like, if you're 13 or better in the field of players that recruited, there's a good chance that No, just ignore that. That's actually wrong. I'm misreading. I wrote shorthand. I'm like, that's not true. That I didn't read that right. But that is true.
No, you're good.
Overall, there we go. There's the mix up. When you have this many numbers, you're trying to turn it into something that you're saying out loud. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
What am I doing here?
No, you're good. No.
But it is the 11. No one worse than 11 declared pro, which is a vastly different story from last year.
Yeah.
Last year, there were guys that were – we all were scratching our head about some of the guys that ended up declaring pro.
Yeah.
But, yeah, overall, when you look at the guys that did ultimately go pro, they were sitting around the mid-13s. And then the average of guys that ultimately went pro were sitting – between 14-4 and 15 of wow. Just when you look at like the top five pick lottery, mid late yep. first and late early second. When you look at those picks, that those are the averages of guys that would ultimately go pro. And obviously there's guys that are better and worse, but again, averages in those spots, that's what you're looking at. So those numbers jumped up significantly. And I think that that's probably a testament to the league as a whole and basketball as a whole in the nation of our sim community getting better
right yeah. there. Yeah, no, I was going to touch on that too. Like you mentioned, you know, so this threshold increasing is actually, you know, one of the least surprising things of all of this, just because like you said, the teams got better. And as evidenced by that, you know, the average team between season one and season two increased by half a point, which is a significant jump. And so you would expect since the average team is better, the average player is better, the average player that goes pro has to be better, and you know, yeah. unless the development is coming from the bottom primarily. But just across the board, it makes sense that there are more better players that are at the top that would go pro in season two. And to add to that, season three, there's another 0.36 jump for the average team from season two even. So that's we're getting up to, it's nearly a whole point better in season three from season one for the average team. And so I would expect that overall to increase even more next year as another data point kind of moving forward. So if you have a player that's, you know, if he's near that 11 mark, he might be a little bit safer in season three than he was in season two, just because it looks like teams are getting better. So yeah. I don't think that's surprising. I think it makes sense. The surprising thing to me is just how teams have been able to get so much better. I'm curious to see, you know, where that kind of tops off, where that plateaus, because I mean, everyone can't get better forever. At some point, this simulation is going to even out. Right. And that's when after maybe a season or two or three of it evening out, we're going to have a better idea of what the actual threshold is. But for now, you know, season two, it looked like it was around that 11 mark, where if you were below that, you weren't going to at least, did you say it was under 11, didn't declare or didn't stay in the draft?
All right. So I was actually going to say this because I finally figured out my shorthand that I was completely butchering earlier.
Yeah, so, you're good.
Again, it is true that you had to be better than an 11 to declare this year.
Okay. Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of those guys did return.
Gotcha.
There was one guy, there were like, yeah, three guys that were a 10-6 and a 10-7. So that those are the three anomalies, but they all still ultimately came gotcha. Back. That was it. Essentially, you had to be better than an 11 in order to declare at all. And gotcha. Then my shorthand that I botched of saying all the three players that stayed in the draft were 13 or better. So there were three guys that were sitting at a 12 and a half, basically. They're about give or take one or two decimal points. But everyone else was a 13 or better. So 37 of the 40 wow. players were 13 overall or better this season. And that doesn't account for the numbers that we see on the NBA draft page on the Google Doc that accounts for the development. So just looking at it that way, yeah, all gotcha. The three of them were 13 or better.
So, yeah, like I said, I think we could see those numbers jump up even a little bit more this next year. But that's, right. you know, that's a great thing to keep in mind, just the fact that this year it was around a 12-5, and then next year, so it could be a little higher, the guys that stay in the draft. But like you mentioned, I think this is something we wanted to dive into a little bit more because I think this is going to be a really important point and it could be a strategy point. You mentioned that the numbers for the overalls that were shown on the draft declarations page were not the numbers that the players performed at this year during season two. They were the numbers that they would have been set at during season three. So it was post the development. So if you had a player that was, you know, 11.0 and he was a high development and you had a high development or full development strategy, he would have jumped up to 13. That's the number that shows up on the draft declarations page. And the reason that it seems like that's significant is because of the fact that if they're taking those numbers into account, then potentially reducing the amount that you declare or that you develop could result in fewer declarations. But I think you have a little bit more information that could be helpful to kind of set that up too.
The biggest, this is like, if you're listening to this podcast and you're only half listening now and you're thinking about turning it off, this is probably the biggest takeaway that differs from what we talked about last time. And again, it's not like this is a set in stone thing. This is just a theory based on what we're looking at here. Is it does appear that what your development numbers are set to can impact where this guy, where your guy ultimately moves up or down the draft board. Because we know that the top 40 guys stayed in the draft and the bottom 60 guys came back. So where the big question is, how do you fit your guy into that draft board? And so based on what we're looking at here, it feels as if based on how you ultimately develop your team, your guy will go up or down accordingly on that draft board. Now, if it's whether or not it's enough for him to fall out of the top 40 of players that ultimately go it remains to be seen. But there's a number of players on here that were relatively surprising to me that they didn't end up going pro. And then ultimately looking to see what they developed to, it made a little bit more sense. For instance, Villanova had a 5-time leading scorer, one of the best low loyalty guys last season. He was like a top 20 something low loyalty guy when you compare just low loyalty and where they fall as scoring leaders. And whatnot. And so he ultimately was one of the best low loyalty scorers and he was sitting at a 13-4 and he declared for the draft, but based on Villanova's development, he only developed 0.4 points to a 13.8. And so imagining if he ends up going with a high development emphasis, he gets 1.6 points better. And now we're looking at a 15 overall. That might have moved him up the board enough as a 5-time leading scorer, low loyalty guy. That could have moved him up into the conversation of guys that, for instance, like a Nate McCaskill, who is a 14-5 guy from Baylor that ultimately ended up going pro after development. And there's other guys that are sitting at 13-6, 13-5. Like that could have been enough to catapult him in. Now, I don't know if that's what would have happened, but like 5-time leading scorer is one of the few outliers of players that when you look at the best leading scorers that are low loyalty that didn't go, there were organizing it that way by saying, all right, let's look at just the low loyalty guys and the best leading scorers from that bunch. The all three 7-time leading scorers went pro that were low loyalty. All 4 6-time leading scorers that were low loyalty went pro. All the fives, which are there's about like there was all but one of the five. That's what we're getting to. So what is that? 7 of the 8 fives ultimately went 5-time leading scorers ultimately went pro. This is the one guy that didn't.
Right.
And why did he not? It's potentially because their loyalty or the development on him wasn't nearly as high, and he only stuck as a 13.8 as opposed to some of these other guys. Now, again, this could just be me reading into something that's not necessarily there, but when you take it a step further and you look and see the breakdown of who fell into the top 5 pick category, who was a lottery pick category and so forth and all the way down, you look at the development on the guys that were top 5 picks, the average development per player was 1.3 points. The lottery average development was 1.1 points. And then the mid to late first guys' average development was 0.8 points. And all those guys were above like 14.5 between those three categories. But ultimately, the top five picks jumped to 16.38, so 16.4 overall. Lottery jumps from actually being better overall category from season two rosters, but when you look at season three rosters and what it would have developed to, they get slightly worse than the top five picks, and then so forth to the mid to late first. So I know there's a lot of numbers, but basically the takeaway is that the players that fall in the top five pick range and the players that fall in the lottery range, the top five pick actually has a lower overall season two rating than the guys that fall in the lottery. But after, when you consider what they developed to season three, it jumps. The average overall for the top five picks jumps to about a 16.4 versus a lottery being a 16.3 overall player. And so that right. seems like minuscule, but it goes to show that there seems to be a significance on development and what the player ultimately becomes. And that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So just to kind of summarize that super briefly too. So basically, to clarify, you know, in my own head too, it's like that Villanova player you're talking about, he could have been, out of all the players that declared for the draft, he could have been the 30th best player based on his season two rating. And I'm making that number up, but he could have been the 30th best player. But because Villanova chose to develop less, they had less of an emphasis on development this year and they focused more on recruiting, he didn't develop. And so players behind him in that rating, that top, you know, 100 players that were thinking about going pro, a lot of those players jumped him, which enabled him to fall back below that 40th or that top 40th player overall on the actual draft board, which as a result made it more likely that he would return to school. And so basically the takeaway, like you said, is that it seems like the coaches have a little bit of influence on whether these players go pro based on how highly they develop how focused they are on development. And this is different than what we thought in the past, because in the past we thought it was basically all based on the ratings from that season. So we thought going into the draft, it was all based on season two's ratings. But in reality, it looks like, again, this is a theory, but it looks like it's based on the ratings that those players would have had in season three, which takes into account that development. So this is a significant thing. If you have a player that is higher, is a 13.0 already, and you're worried about him going pro, if you don't have a lot of roster spots to fill, you still might focus more on recruiting just because it might be able to keep that guy there. But again, it's just another strategy point to keep in mind that is different than what we thought in the past. And I think it's an important thing, to kind of use that nugget going forward.
And two things. So I'll leave a little bookmark and I'll say Jay George is a bookmark just to say the other side of that thing. So I'll say that first. But you think about transfers and basically players transferring out and how that works. And we found out ultimately that it is also based on the number of the following season, and it's not based on the number there. So it would not be surprising if NBA draft is based on what they would ultimately become the following right. season, because part of the sim already incorporates that.
Right. Yeah. And the other point there is too, you know, it kind of makes sense. Using that Villanova guy as an example, again, it's like from our perspective as players of the simulation, as you know, Villanova's head coach, you can see that his development rating is high. But if you're an NBA scout and you're not in the simulation world, again, I'm just likening this to real life. You only see that he developed, you know, a little bit this year. He didn't have the development that some other guys did. So even though he's listed as a high development, if you're an NBA scout, it doesn't really look like he develops that fast. And so you might be less inclined to draft him. So just likening this simulation to real life, that aspect of it also seems to make sense that they would use the season three's numbers in this case to put together the draft board rather than the season two numbers.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, like we were talking about which guys fell in the lottery, which guys fell in the top five. And again, the average lottery player was better season two overall than the average top five player by about, you know, a tenth of a point, which is still, when you're talking about this number of players, it's still substantial. And then when you consider what they were at the end of the season, the top five guys were ultimately better for what they would be for next season. So, I mean, yeah, like whether or not that necessarily is the determining factor of if they go or not. That remains to be seen. But at least comparatively to where they fall on the draft board, that seems obvious that they're choosing the guys top five that were about as good as the lottery guys, but not quite. But ultimately, at the end of the season, would develop to be a better player. So that, I think that just goes to show, you know, it does weigh a bearing on it, you know.
Definitely.
And then the Jay George thing, the Jay George bookmark that I was going to say.
Yep.
Jay George, Seton Hall's head coach, you know, I know he has his own podcast and I love listening to that too. And all their Heat Check updates, those are a lot of fun. We always hear about Jay George, his best player that he figured was going to go pro all along. I didn't think that Jay George was going to go pro based on what we were talking about last year, since he was he's a low development guy. And so, but that said, he's a 16.4 overall, very good player. Yeah. Now, the fact that Seton Hall appears to have gone all in on recruiting this year, because he ended up developing nothing this year, and the fact that he still went pro means that, you know, just because you don't develop the guy doesn't mean that they're not going to go pro, because he's still good.
He's still really good.
I will say he fell to being the 33rd ranked prospect. I would imagine that if he's 16-4 overall and he would have done some sort of development, that if he's jumping to like a, let's say a 17 or whatever it might be, that he would be moving up the draft board. So it wasn't enough for him to fall off the top 40, but he got close.
Yeah, he got close. Yeah, just because he wasn't developed. Yeah, that's a fantastic point.
He wasn't developing. And you look at one of the main things that I'm seeing, like one of the cutoff guy that did not go pro, Duke, Sam Steele, a junior center that was a 17 overall, good player. High development guy, medium loyalty, high development, 17 overall. Seems like someone that's surefire to go pro when you're talking about a prestige that high. But he was only their he's a four-time leading scorer, which is lower, but he was their best player and on a prestige one. So someone that you'd figure to go pro, he developed only 0.8 points as a high loyalty guy. Mm. And so then you're looking at him being the first man off the block, basically, of returning, which is wild to become a 17.8. He'll come back for senior year.
Yeah.
But it's one of those guys that, you know, you'd figure it would go, but if they didn't develop him that much, it apparently was enough for him to fall off the list.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. I just think that's a huge thing that we learned basically this time around. And again, this isn't set in stone, but it feels like it definitely is a factor. We'll see if it continues to be the case in the future. But based on this data set, it looks like that's very significant.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I wouldn't go to my grave saying it's 100% a thing. But looking at the numbers and what the numbers from one season of data tell us, it looks like it's something that could be something that is included. You know, the fact that they throw those numbers out there on the Heat Check page. And the fact that, like we said, when you're recruiting players and transfers happen, like players can de-recruit from your team because all of a sudden the guy on your team got a point better, and now all of a sudden this guy is worse than the guy on your team, and so he'll end up decommitting. And so the fact that it's part of the game already in a different area, and the fact that we're showing it on the Heat Check Sim with the updated rankings of overall ability for each player, and then the trends that we see here, that those three things are enough to tell me that I would imagine that it has something to do with it. But again, I'm not saying set in stone. This is 100% something that is part of the game. But my guess is based on this, I would say it is.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, that seems like a really good, you know, breakdown of how kind of things, further developed based on our season two data set in tandem with our season one data set. Just really quickly, were there any players that you were surprised declared for the draft based on any of the trends we had kind of talked about previously? Or on the other end, were there any players that you were surprised didn't declare?
Yeah, I kind of did a number of them. I mentioned a number of them throughout. But guys that I said throughout the episode that were interesting to me and kind of were telling to me were leading scorer Eric Townsend, who didn't end up going. The second leading scorer, Swift, from
UConn.
Western Michigan and UConn, respectively. Yep. Both those guys didn't go, but it looked like it made sense as to why
When you look and see Swift was only a low development guy, but he was a freshman and from UConn, prestige too. So that was a little surprising to me. And then Townsend, the sixth man on that team, was only an 11-4, which would have been good enough for last season, but this season didn't necessarily meet that criteria of going pro early. So those guys were surprising. Middleton from Florida was the one that I mentioned that he hit pretty much all the marks, except for the fact that he was, you know, he had 7-time leading scorer, prestige one, best player. But the fact that he was a junior and a highly loyal guy, even though he was highly developing, he ended up staying. So those were a couple. But one that was interesting, I need to find it again. There was a guy on Michigan State, if I can find it. There was a guy in Michigan State that was interesting because he fell into the category of being, you know, a really talented player. And I think he was lowly loyal, but he was like the fifth best player on their roster. And he didn't even declare for the draft. And so that was kind of surprising and just goes to show that where you fall on the roster still does make an impact, because he was a pretty good player and knocked off a few of those categories that we've discussed, but he didn't even declare for the draft at all. And same thing with the guy I said from Indiana, who was one of the better low loyalty guys as well, but not one time a leading scorer because he was the seventh best player on his roster. So that was one of those things that you kind of, it just goes to show. Yeah, both Michigan State and Indiana had a guy also that were 13s, both low loyalty. One of the Indiana guy was a low high, and neither of them ultimately even wanted to test the water. So just interesting takeaways from there for sure.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where, you know, if you have one of these trends fits the bill for one of your players, it's not necessarily something that you need to already sound the alarms, but the more of these trends, the higher number of these trends that are applicable to a player on your team, the more worried you should be. So if you're a high prestige team and you got a really good player, et cetera, low loyalty, high development, like that, it's the accumulation of these factors that really should sound the alarms, not one by itself, is kind of my takeaway there, at least.
Definitely. I know, also shout out to Pittsburgh's coach who reached out to me, and we were talking about Gary Perkins, the center, and how he has had the worst luck, the absolute worst luck with his centers. He had two go pro last year, got to transfer from Louisville, good one, center Gary Perkins. And then he was he didn't even put his name in the running to go pro. He was a 12.6, but he only a 12.6 low high, but he was just the fifth best player on his team and on one time leading scorer. So one time like being that low of a leading scorer, there wasn't a single player that was a one time leading scorer that ended up going pro. There were a handful of guys that were two time leading scorers, but they were also elite players overall.
This is fascinating stuff. I think we were able to, you know, kind of provide some new insight, some further strategy for the listeners. So I think that was a really, really fantastic breakdown of kind of using season two's results in tandem with season one's to kind of get further insight into what goes into that process. So unless you had anything else there, I'm happy to move on. There was one other thing I wanted to touch on with you, but I'll give you another chance if there's anything else.
Yeah, I'll just say, because we're talking about scoring leaders, I'll just wrap things up real cleanly with this one last thing on breaking down, looking at the projections of where players are supposed to go in the draft. And just to mention, kind of recap to where we were at the beginning of talking about scoring leaders and how it changed. It wasn't necessarily an end-all be-all of you being the best scorer and you go pro, but now all the other factors seem to matter, even if you are a 9-plus time leading scorer. To bring it all in full circle, looking at the guys and where people are supposed to go, the top five picks, average scoring leader between them would be a 6-time leading scorer. The lottery would be a 4.9-time leading scorer. Mid to late first was about a 4.2. Late early second was about a 4.7. So it jumped up, but the players overall from last season weren't as good. And then so forth from there. But basically the main takeaway is that the top five picks were an average of a 6-time leading scorer, all of whom were freshmen, by the way. And then it dropped down little by little from there.
That's a great way to kind of wrap it up. I think still, emphasize the importance of that scoring leaders slice of the pie, if you will.
Also just noticing this too, the prestige, looking at it, the guys that were fell into the late second and undrafted area, both those guys actually were relatively high in the scoring leader average, of the late second average being a 5-time leading scorer and an undrafted average being a 4.5-time leading scorer. But the big difference was they were mostly from small schools, because the prestiges were averaged of 3.7 and 3.5. So a lot of those guys from small schools ultimately committed to the draft originally, but they were sitting only around a 12 overall. And so they weren't nearly as good as the guys that were great leading scorers and great overall from big time schools. So just kind of put a bow on everything.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, I mean, the other thing that I kind of wanted to touch on briefly, just because it's also relevant in terms of the timing of the Sim universe and what's happened recently, I was just curious on your thoughts of the, you know, the recent transfer cycle. I could have maybe just forgotten this, but I was wondering, was the number of offers being listed for each player, was that new this time around?
Yeah, that was new. Because first go around, just like there was no crystal ball, obviously, and that was a new addition. They, I guess you didn't want to do crystal ball for this, which I respect, because I didn't end up landing anyone. But if I was going up against, if you see Radford on there and all of a sudden Duke's like, well, I would feel good like this. I think I would get beat out every single time. And so I respect the no crystal ball on transfers when you're competing with, you know, sharks versus minnows. But the offers also, like, things got wild.
It did.
And it was, I'll be darned, freaking Chattanooga, man. That person, I went for someone that I had lower offers on, felt decent to transfer from Gonzaga. And Chattanooga had beaten me out on transfers or on recruits throughout the season. And then, once again, lo and behold, I see my guys sitting on freaking Chattanooga's roster. They're going to have a good team of Radford wannabes right there. So
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't remember who it was, so I won't try to give credit to anyone just because I don't want to get it wrong. But someone on Discord, I believe, mentioned that they had reached out to Eli about whether there would be a crystal ball for the transfers. And it sounded like, based on what they said, that it was something that he was working on, but it was kind of, it came down to the last minute. And so to me, it makes me wonder if this was ultimately his solution and that's the way it'll stay, or if, you know, we still could see a crystal ball in the future. Cause like you said, I think it makes sense that in some cases you don't necessarily want to show, you know, Radford leading when it might be a player that a school like Duke could be interested in, but it still could be helpful. So I could see that going either way. I don't think I would really complain. I know there were people that were disappointed that there wasn't a crystal ball, but ultimately I think just the fact that you got to see the number of offers helped, you know, me enough at least to make relatively informed decisions. I was able to, you know, still kind of pivot in cases where I offered someone and the player then received a boatload of offers. Like, I could still pivot and try to, like you said, offer someone that had a low number of offers. It just doesn't give you that sense of security that you're leading going into, you know, the closing hour, the closing minutes of that cycle. But
did you end up getting anyone?
I didn't. I just offered one player, a point guard, who he would have been my best player on this team. I didn't have any open roster spots, so he would have been the best player on my team, not by a large margin, but I offered one player, I think his name was Alfonso McNeely. He had like 13 other offers, so I wasn't like really expecting to land him by any means, but he ended up going to Notre Dame, so didn't have much of a chance there. I tried to sell him on being the stud on our team, but he wanted to play on, you know, a more prestigious school, which I can't really argue with. I didn't land anyone, but I was able to, you know, move forward with the full roster. I didn't have to pick up any, you know, random guys at the end of the transfer market. So that was good.
That's good. Yeah. That's a problem you don't want to have.
Right. Next year I'm going to have a bunch of, this coming year, I have no seniors again, but then the year after that I'll have three. And so that's the season where I'm going to, It'll be interesting. I'm going to be focused a little bit more on recruiting, and that's the season where I'm definitely worried about, you know, striking out to some degree in recruiting and having to fill it with a bad transfer. But I'm hoping it doesn't get to that point. It's a few seasons away, so I'll worry about that when it gets here.
Yeah, I was really hoping to get a transfer just because, like, I have – it's, yeah, just like you were saying, 2 seasons away, though, I have, like, I want to say, like, 4 juniors right now for next season, and then 2 seasons they'll all be seniors, and I don't want to – That sounds horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause even if you, even if you land one recruit each cycle, you're still, you still come down to the transfer, and that's daunting for sure. Especially if there's no crystal ball, but
I was really hoping to try and squeeze out another junior and get him to even be a sophomore. Ideally, I was going for a freshman, but, just to no avail, but hey, we're talking about champagne problems right here. When your best player was like an 8-9 or whatever, or your worst player was an 8-9. It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how far your team can go this year. You've got a really solid squad, a squad that you know, should scare some of those higher profile schools that you're going to be playing against, and hopefully you can knock off some of those guys for, you know, the mid majors around that are always cheering for the other mid majors to knock off some of those schools.
I'll take all the mid-major support I can get. We need it. Rowdy Ready Nation can only go so far when we're playing the top recruit in the nation with Minnesota, and then the recruiting classes that these other guys like Creighton and Washington and George Mason all had. And then we have you guys. Come on now.
Exactly. See, I'm already falling off the priority list. No, you're already not worried about me. You that was a quick turnaround. No, it'll be good. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you guys are actually we have Seton Hall on our schedule. So you guys after Seton Hall are our second toughest opponent. So yeah, we're gonna be geared up. We're gonna be excited to play you guys and to host you.
Yeah, your place is gonna be going crazy, that's for sure.
Yeah, hopefully there won't be any, you know, COVID restrictions for our attendance, and we'll be able to just pack the house for that game.
Hey, West Virginia's players starting to spread rumors that we don't need to have happen in this sim world.
Yeah, that was definitely something that was scary. Yeah, you don't want that spreading, because that would be a virus even worse than COVID, honestly, for the sim world.
If you haven't seen it, if you guys don't know what we're talking about, go check out that tweet. It's one of the best of the simulations.
yeah, definitely. It's hilarious. I think that kind of touched on everything I wanted to. I think you did a fantastic job breaking down, you know, the trends we saw from season one to season two now for draft declarations. I'm continue to be curious to see how those develop. But I think we were able to gain and provide some more insight to the listeners there on that end. So in that way, I hope it was productive for the listeners. I think they'll enjoy it. And yeah, thanks again for coming on. If there's anything else you want to plug with your Twitter handle or anything else where people can find you, feel free to do that.
I think I'm Radford HC Sim. I always forget the Sim part. I want to say that's it. But I'm on Twitter there. Try to stay active on that. It's fun to be involved with all the other teams on the Twitter sphere and make it actually feel a little bit more like a college basketball simulation, you know.
Definitely. And you've done a fantastic job from my perspective of, you know, responding to people's questions within Discord too. So for those listeners that are looking for more information and aren't on Discord, I would look at your Heat Check Sim emails and make sure you're finding or looking for that link and getting onto the Discord as soon as possible, because there's a lot of great information being shared there as well.
Season 3 just around the corner, man.
Season 3, it's coming up. Yep. I'm looking forward to I've got a podcast coming up, episode with Fake Joe Lunardi, and looking forward to sharing that. But for now, that's all I had. Thanks again for joining me, and looking forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thanks for having me, man. Good talking with you, as always.
Absolutely. Before we close, I wanted to give you an idea of what's to come within the Heat Check Sim universe before the next episode is released. At the end of the day on September 13th, non-conference schedules are due. That's midnight Eastern time. Following that deadline, off-season budgets should become available, which would mean they are due at the end of the day Tuesday, September 15th, assuming we are following the same schedule that we have previously. I would recommend waiting to fill out your off-season budget form until you listen to my episode with Fake Joe Lenardi, as it sounds like he's preparing info for our conversation that could influence some of the off-season budget decisions you make. Just as a heads up, the plan is to release the episode Tuesday morning, so you should be able to give it a listen and still submit your off-season budget form before the deadline of midnight Eastern on Tuesday. I'll make sure to keep you in the loop on Twitter and Discord if our planned release date for the Season 3 preview episode changes, but as of right now, it is on track to be released Tuesday in time to help you with all your off-season budgets. As always, you can find me on Twitter at HCSimShow. Please feel free to send in comments and questions, and I will do my best to incorporate my responses into future episodes. Thanks for listening, and I'm looking forward to bringing you that Season 3 preview deep dive episode with Fake Joe Lenardi earlier this week. See you later.